My friend, how are you? Welcome back. It's episode 5 of season 3. We're joined by Dom Hyams, Dom Scott. Oodles and oodles of experience to share with us. He's been on TV in Crip on a Run. He's been working for Channel 4 and is now the global client director for Purple Goat Agency, a disability-focused design agency. I could go on. This episode, we'll talk about all of that, all of the things that we want to see, all of the amazing things that are to come, reflecting on some of the things from the past too. So buckle up, get ready, chill out, relax, because it's time to dive in to the safe place.
Thank you so much, Gavin. Hi, I'm Dom Hyams. I'm Global Client Director at Purple Goat Agency, which might be a lot of words, but essentially I oversee all new opportunities that come into Purple Goat Agency, which is the world's first and only disability-led, inclusion-focused marketing agency in the world. I'm disabled myself. I've got osteogenesis imperfecta, more commonly known as brittle bones, and have meandered around kind of different disability-related, media-related roles ever since being in a sort of sports TV world back in 2010, and worked on the Paralympics, and that basically changed my direction from never really, you know, engaging in sort of disability beforehand, and then moving sort of from there into various angles to end up where I am today.
And what prompted that first move then into the, I mean, obviously the Paralympics is a massive thing, and it's kind of exciting to be part of. But what made you go for that? What was the change?
To be honest, it was, so I was studying management at university, and I always thought that I was going to go into like marketing, advertising, and I got out of the university and got onto what was called like the fellowship for WPP, which is like their grant scheme basically. But I went into my first kind of placement as part of that, and then was moved into the second. And that was when kind of financially crashy 2018-19 kind of thing was happening, which wasn't ideal, and people weren't advertising as much. And so I was basically put on ice. They were like, oh, sorry, we've got an employment freeze, we can't move you around. And an opportunity to join the Channel 4 grad scheme came up. And I'd previously done a documentary with Channel 4 when I was 18 called Crip on a Trip, which is documenting me going around Europe interrailing with my mates. I mean, it was a great experience, but obviously I saw the power of TV from in front of them behind the camera. And so when the opportunity to apply for Channel 4 came up, it really felt like an opportunity to, you know, create things and help shape the how people see humanity and society, really. And you're placed in a different like production company as part of your grad scheme if you get on. And I did get on, and I got placed at Sunset and Vine, which was a sports TV production company that was producing the Paralympic Games. So it was all quite circumstantial in some ways. Obviously, I knew that was a production company, that was an opportunity, and I love sport. I loved, like, you know, as a kid watching the Olympics, you know, probably more so than the Paralympics, and I was obsessed with it. You know, like, I'd get my parents to put me in front of the Olympics for as many hours as I was allowed, you know, on any given sort of Olympic year. And so when the opportunity to work on the Paralympics came up, it just felt like an amazing experience to be a part of. I was kind of part of a team for maybe the 2 years before, helping kind of shape what it would look like when it came to be. And then in games time, working at the Olympic Park for the whole, like, I mean, it was 20 something days there. And I was saying this to someone the other day, actually, and there was a moment of working at the games where I opened a newspaper, or didn't even open it, to be fair. The front and the back of the newspaper, I think it was the Times, was just David Weir in his wheelchair, with a, you know, Union Jack draped over him, and it was kind of him across the two sides of the page. And I remember thinking at that time, I was like, I don't think I ever expected to see that kind of representation in my lifetime. Mm. And it was wholly positive, and it was powerful. And obviously, you know, in some small part, I'd been a part of that in, you know, working on the games for Channel 4 to bring that to life. And it was a really, like, powerful experience. We often talk about how there was a step change in people's psyche around disability in 2012. I mean, not all of it was, like, perfect, because you had this polarized view of triumph over adversity. Everyone that's successful as a disabled person
superhero
must want to be a Paralympian. Yeah, a superhero. And you had the kind of pity party of disability that still was very much a kind of an easy sort of narrative that you see in the media and in advertising as well. So we didn't really get the bit in the middle, but we did at least get more of the conversation and more representation and people feeling more comfortable in and around disability overarchingly. And so for me, that was like a massive turning point in showing me that actually maybe I could help steer that conversation forward and make it more nuanced, make it more progressive over time. And that's really the sort of journey I've been on since then.
Really interesting. I mean, we went through university at similar times by the sound of it. So I mean, I left in 2007 and was kind of working in banking, actually, during that crash, which was an experience in itself.
Absolutely.
And I never really saw it, because in the sense of disability related at that point, because I don't like to think of myself as, I don't think of it in lucky, but perhaps more privileged in a way, in that my disabilities, particularly back then, were very non-visible. So unless you had a keen eye, you wouldn't necessarily have gone, oh yes, he's got a disability. Because mine were lower limb, or are lower limb. And yeah, if you know about the conditions, so it's congenital talipes, equinovirus, that I was born with. And then that's just kind of gotten worse over the years and turned into other things, as these things do. But I never really saw that. And I don't think I had the same attachment to the Paralympics then. But I now look back at it and kind of think that, and wonder, I suppose, because I now play wheelchair rugby, wheelchair basketball, which I didn't even really know about when I was younger. And I wonder how much of an influence the Paralympic Games had then. And I also wonder how it's going to have an influence this year, if as much. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
I think, I mean, with my both professional hat on and personal hat on, I think that the games are a real opportunity every 4 years where the eyes of the world are on disability in a way that maybe they're not any other time. Mm. And so I always think of it as an opportunity to progress the conversation on. You know, like, we saw what I will call just really strong representation in London. And then things progressed on in Rio, where, you know, they wanted to create a little bit more nuance and a little bit more punch to the conversation. And then in Tokyo, it kind of moved away from the sort of superhuman a little bit, mm-hmm. and it tried to talk about the human narrative. And then again, we're moving on again, and it's, you know, we're going to have another kind of iteration of what that kind of conversation, particularly through Channel 4, is going to be. We've actually been working with Channel 4 in and around that, like, creative ideation, and they've wanted to work with the community to make sure that it, like, hits home, but it is also still progressive and punchy. And it's been a really, you know, positive, powerful experience doing that. But very personally, you know, there's so much we could talk about and throw into the sort of the general public's the main that maybe they don't have an appreciation for, and it's maybe not appropriate or possible to conceive that, you know, we can start having conversations about the lack of accessible housing, or the fact that if you're moving from one locality to another and you've got a care package, it is really impossible. You know, things that affect the disabled population every day, but actually, if you're not in and around that world, you don't necessarily know it. So for me, there's definitely like an opportunity to have some more nuanced conversations and raise kind of issues and understanding in and around areas that maybe people have not really appreciated before. So that's kind of like where I see the sort of value and the opportunity there. I would say that it definitely, you know, you can't escape the fact that it is the platform that, you know, has the opportunity to, like, I won't use the word inspire, but, you know, create awareness even to the disabled community themselves about something as simple as like having a more progressive way of talking about your own disability, you know, moving away from a ableist tonality where you think actually your life is this and that's what you should expect from it, and instead going, actually no, there's intrinsic barriers on me here, and I didn't really realize that the world's essentially, you know, been built in a way that wasn't necessarily befitting to my needs. So I think that it's also a really powerful opportunity to like plant that in the community's sort of psyche as well, where they suddenly realize this and appreciate that there should be parity in everything, and hopefully get that kind of fire in the belly, as it were, a little bit as well. So yeah, that's a very long-winded way of answering your question, that essentially, yes, I think like it is a really powerful moment, and it's a really important moment across the board.
And what has your experience been like then with that? And I would call it acceptance of your own disability and the external influences that are put upon you. What's that journey been like for you, kind of growing up? And you mentioned sport in particular. I mean, how has that worked for you?
So, interestingly, like growing up, and I often almost struggle to articulate this bit of it, but like I don't remember any time in my childhood where I wasn't utterly accepting of who I was, my physicality, my opportunity, and my aspirations and abilities. And often, like, people really struggle to like wrap their head around that, but I never remember any moment in my life at all of like, oh, my friends can do this, I can't do this, or what, I'm never going to be able to do that. Like, I don't know, but like my parents always brought me up with real open honesty about what I could do, what I could aspire to do, what might be possible, what I should push the boundaries of, and it was just a really open dialogue, including things about like life expectancy and everything, and again, for as early as I can remember, it was just an open conversation, and that meant that all through my childhood, like, you know, my parents were sort of like so passionate about giving me every opportunity and encouraging me often to do things that even I was marginally afraid of, shall we say. You know, like they'd be like, go and try that ride at the fairground, or go and do that trip independently. And, you know, I might have hesitation, but they were like, no, like, go for it, try it. And I think, again, that really set me in good stead, but it also meant that in my younger life, I had very few barriers actually on me. Like, I didn't feel disabled because there wasn't a lot disabling me from what I wanted to do. I went to a mainstream school. I had non-disabled friends almost exclusively, not by choice, but that was just the people that were around me. And so there was very little engagement with the community of disability, with the identity of disability, even though I would be the first person to make a joke about myself, talk about what was wrong with me, you know, like it was utterly just part of any other feature and be like, I've got brown hair, I've got brittle bones, no big deal, yeah, kind of thing. And then as I got older, I think, A, you realise essentially there's an element of privilege that goes into your life. Like, you know, I got to university and I got out of university and I realised that actually my upbringing and my opportunities had been ones that had obviously helped form and shape who I was, but they had very much set me with a confidence about, you know, who I was and what I could do and everything else in between. And I saw that not everyone from the disabled community necessarily felt that or had that. And that just naturally made me more engaged with the disabled community, like as a start, you know, either supporting like charity related things, mentoring things at university, whatever else it might be. And then obviously that experience of both making the documentary and then kind of working in TV afterwards, again, you're in a position where you're able to like help craft a narrative in and around disability and hopefully a progressive one. And again, so that was like where the sort of fire in the belly, I suppose, around both identity but also engaging with that came. And then I suppose finally, you know, you're an adult and suddenly all the things that were there as a child are not there. So, you know, wanting to move house becomes really tough.
Yeah.
And you just have to like take a leap of faith, or you have to find somewhere that's not truly accessible and make it more accessible somehow. You have to get really good at letter writing because things aren't in place for you. So you have to stand up for what you want and what you need and really push the boundary and the envelope of, you know, making opportunities for yourself. You know, in employment, just a confidence to say, hey guys, does anyone want to take me to the loo? Because I'm new here and I don't really want to get a carer that has to sit in the corner for every day that I'm here, and it could be someone that I'm working with. Anyone fancy it? And that's an email that I generally sent on the first day of working at a couple of places. And again, like, I know that that's just because of who I was that I felt comfortable and to do that, but that's not a normal thing, and that shouldn't necessarily be a thing that people have to do, you know, of course. So I think, you know, as you grow older, you grow more aware of what big part disability has in your life, even if it's something you're utterly, totally comfortable with and aware of, you know, even from day dot.
Sounds like your parents were just very progressive almost in their kind of approach, in that they sound very open-minded to who you are, the experiences you were having, but also the understanding that your experiences might be different to somebody else's, but difference isn't a bad thing, it's just a difference. Which,
yeah, I think that's exactly it.
Yeah, that is,
yeah,
an amazing thing, I would say, actually. I think that's a pretty incredible thing to have parents like that.
I think that they were very aware. So I was born with, 24 hours, 48 hours to live, something like that. And I'd broken 24 bones at birth that they could see on an X-ray because I had it was a natural birth, and they didn't know that I was going to be born with brittle bones.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't normally have a natural birth if that was going to be the case. So, you know, literally came out as a bag of bones, didn't know what was wrong with me. I just looked very different. And about 5 hours later, they kind of diagnosed this, and then a family friend got an OT from the Brittle Bone Society to come and essentially teach the doctors how to save my life. So I think there was an element of realizing that, you know, I don't know, celebrate every day,
yeah,
live it to the full, and try and make the most of every opportunity, and not in a way that's like obsessive, but in a way that's just cherishing and being thankful and just, yeah, really, really harnessing that passion for life. And that's something I really, really have truly always had. Like, I I love all aspects of who I am. I love all the experiences that disability has given me. When people ask, would you change who you are? You know, if you could sort of click your fingers and not be disabled, would you do that? And I wholeheartedly say, no, I wouldn't change who I was, because I wouldn't, A, be who I was, yeah. But B, all the experiences I've had, there's so many that I know are purely for the fact that I'm disabled, and that's led me in a certain meandering journey. So yeah, I think that it definitely kind of stems from that, and absolutely all credit really to, yeah, my parents, my sister as well, you know, she's a non-disabled older sibling, and you know, that's also really hard. Mm-hmm. You suddenly have, you know, all of that like open dialogue that was happening, but then also so much kind of like attention is having to go to me, and that's also a really tough place. Like we get so good at like sharing, because I'd always get freebies everywhere, and you know, so it's like instilled certain things in our relationship just from the get-go, but like not obviously all great, because there's, I know, moments that I took way too much of the like attention there, but at the same time there's again like other qualities that are really nice that and things that we experience because of that too.
Yeah, and I mean I'm one of three, and my older brother had something similar in that, you know, I was born very obviously, they didn't know that I was going to come out with deformed lower limbs, because they just didn't have the equipment really to understand that at that point. Yeah. Which makes me feel very old. And then you've got all that kind of, you know, all the physio, all the different surgeries, the accidents that I would have as a result of, yeah, not being as well balanced as others, and all those sort of things over the years. And it does put a strain. But if I look at my younger brother, he put equal strain on the kind of dynamic, just because that's what happens to a certain extent. And I think having that experience, I also think helps people to support others as they go out into the kind of wider world. So your sister, I'm sure now, would be as much of an advocate or an ally, I should say, for disabled people as anyone else should be.
Oh, of course.
Which, yeah, that's a powerful thing in its own right. And it's almost that kind of butterfly effect, I suppose, of the things that we touch and the influences that we have. But it was interesting you said about the people asking if you change, and if you choose not to be disabled. I find that such an odd question to ask somebody, because what you're actually asking them is you're asking them if you want to be a different person, if you want to not exist effectively. And it's like, what a question.
And again, it's like it comes from a place of really entrenched ableism. Like, this must be so bad that, of course, you want to be something else.
Yeah,
or have a different thing. I had a shop owner the other week, literally down the parade of shops near me, and you know, you get it all the time, but it was a really funny one. It was like, how do you? You don't mind me asking, how do you cope? And I was like, sorry, what do you mean? She's like, you know, how do you cope with life? And I was like, well, I work in London. I drive my car. You drive a car?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I live there with my partner. Like, what? And I was like, literally blowing her mind. Like, it was, she just couldn't believe it. And I was like, no, I have a great life, thank you. And it's a bit nice to see you. And that was the interaction. But, you know, her perception, her experience of disability has been so obviously one-dimensional.
Yeah.
That was an interaction that she thought was utterly valid. And she just really was curious how, like, I was disabled and was smiling and asking her how her day was.
Yeah.
And because she never had an interaction like that before. And so it's moments like that that you realise there is still so much work to do. And I don't think it's like, you know, I don't think of it as work, but it's more that there's just so many intrinsic barriers like still there that people just aren't aware of and aren't kind of educating themselves on. We still haven't had that moment of like mass self-education and like reflection around disability, where people kind of almost check themselves and check their prejudices and then kind of like start taking action to change that, you know what I mean? And maybe we'll get there. Maybe it will take something really awful to happen for people to start, you know, thinking about disability in that new way. But it's definitely a fascinating one.
I'd love to say that in my lifetime, however long that will be, that there will be a significant shift in people's mindsets. I really want to believe that. But as you can probably tell, I'm not sure I do. And it's mainly because I think we are so early on in that kind of journey, which also feels really corporate-y when I say journey. But the progression of people's understanding. And there's so much more that needs to be done. I mean, even if you look at the kind of scientific side of stuff, so if you look at medicine and if you look at psychology and the kind of research that goes on in those areas, there still isn't adequate representation even in that. It's a bit like all these adverts we're seeing on TV at the moment around women experiencing pain and generally getting worse outcomes as a result of going to the doctors because they're female. And it's a similar sort of kind of premise that until you do all the kind of work on the in the background to actually fully understand and explore these things, you're never really going to get to the outcome that we should get. And it feels like it's still relatively surface level for me, which is much better than it was. You know, I now feel comfortable, as an example, saying that I'm disabled. Whereas if you'd asked me 5-10 years ago, I wouldn't have felt comfortable for it. Partly because I always felt a bit of a fraud saying it because I looked relatively okay. I mean, I wasn't, but I looked relatively okay. When maybe now it's because I use more mobility aids and I've kind of come to the acceptance side of things. And I'm kind of, you know, on a really good day, I might use crutches, but on most days I'll use a wheelchair. Once upon a time, I would have thought of that as like the worst thing imaginable, and I genuinely would have thought that. But actually, it's the best thing imaginable because it means that I can do stuff. And a lot of that ultimately comes down to the ableism that we're brought up with. So hopefully, the next generation. I mean, I've got two kids, so I know that they will kind of grow up with a good understanding of it because they'll see my experiences and that'll have a knock-on impact and everything. But hopefully that next generation will push things on even further than our generation maybe can. But I wonder, and particularly with kind of Purple Goat and the kind of social media side of things that I'm sure everyone that listens has kind of seen Purple Goat do you think that's been, or maybe not has been, but do you think it will be the springboard that we need to really get that conversation moving further forward? So when it isn't just this, you know, once every 4 years, we have a discussion because of the Paralympic Games.
Yeah. I would like to say yes, maybe for the fact that like some of the conversations and projects that we're having and working on now are ultimately to like seismically shift how we portray disability in our advertising. So like we are working with some of the biggest brands in the world, the biggest advertisers in the world, and working with them either by sort of, you know, making sort of certain commitments around how much of their advertising is going to be kind of inclusive, and then also supporting behind the scenes to, you know, upskill and create sort of comfort in the people that actually work in these organizations as well, so they sort of feel comfortable, confident in and around disability and inclusion as concepts, so they're better armed to actually put that into their own work moving forward, you know, as well as obviously like hiring the more diverse workforces and things like that. So I think that we are seeing, it's obviously slow progress, and again, like, it's not going to be in the next few years for sure that we're going to see parity. Of course not. But like, we are moving in a direction where people are realizing that creating, you know, equitable sort of experiences, but also like diversity of representation that includes disability in all its guises is really important. And yes, we might not be quite on the same platform as other protected characteristics in terms of like, you know, you would be cancelled now if you did an advertising campaign and it was all men,
yeah.
Or everyone was white, and rightfully so, that you know if you just kind of took the shortcut route and just did the thing that's on your doorstep and that's and didn't think anything of it and didn't try and be inclusive to everyone, I think, you know, you should get some kind of fallback for that. Up to now, maybe disability hasn't been part of that same conversation, and so people just naturally haven't done it because they don't have that lived experience. They're very polite. They don't want to get things wrong. They don't want to get cancelled. But the reality is that that's not right. You know, so ultimately we're working with brands as, you know, as an agency, we've got 50% plus lived experience of disability in the team. So we are kind of authentically handholding these brands and other agencies through the experience of working in and around disability. And our job really is to work with them to do that in a really authentic way that, you know, boosts representation and boosts those progressive narratives in and around disability as well. So, you know, we live and die by the quality of the work that we're associated with. And so for us, having that progressive tonality is fundamentally important. You know, we want to be showing best in class kind of inclusive comms in what we do. And that really is important. And as I say, you know, that's, we're held to that. So it's a great calling card, but at the same time, I suppose there's an element of pressure to it as well, that everything that you put out, you want to resonate with the community, and you want them to, overarchingly, of course, we all have different opinions, so
yeah,
we're not going to please everyone with everything, but at the same time, overarchingly, be positively received by the community, and they think that that's the right direction that we should be going in.
Yeah, and I mean, it's such a diverse community in its own right, which the disability community, you know, the kind of interconnectedness that we have. You kind of touch every race, obviously gender, sexuality within the disability community. So getting that tone right must be challenging, to say the least. Have you ever kind of got it wrong so much that you've had any real pushback?
I'd say no, not in that sense. So the pushback we really have is from brands that want to do disability, but then when we're telling them how it should be to do it authentically, or with the people in the room, or whatever it might be, or not with that specific narrative, because that's not quite what we would, you know, expect or want as the community.
Yeah,
that is where there becomes not conflict, but where we have to put our big boy pants on and explain. You know, we're there as much as we're there as marketeers, we're there as consultants, because we're there like handholding and opening their eyes to this thing that maybe they haven't got the lived experience for and to do. A very simple example is we might see a campaign idea probably like a little bit later than we should, and they've already kind of got the creative concept and it's been done by a creative director that's really like, you know, 30 years in the game, and he's like a really great sort of empathetic sort of creative force in the marketing world. But then you see an ad there and it's just got the word like inspiration, inspiration or whatever, like, and that's the first two words of this huge campaign. And so in the politest way we possibly can, we obviously therefore have to go, okay, we wouldn't use that word typically, and that's not one that resonates particularly well with the community, so we're going to need to change that if we're doing this. And as much as we want our involvement, and as much as they're open, you know, they think that they're open to working with us and creating change, they you can see that the tail goes between the legs and they're a bit miffed. And again, like, that is part of our job. But would we want a campaign with sort of inspirational blazoned on a, you know, in a big ad that, you know, sits online or on a poster in Trafalgar Square or whatever it might be? No. And so so that's where our kind of worth really comes in, and our hopefully the brand's open to us actually supporting them to make those genuine changes. Is the most difficult thing is when you realise that maybe it's a little bit more tick boxy than you wanted and hoped the relationship would be. And very honestly, we don't get very much of that at all, and it, you very quickly spot it now. But it is something that I think even the brands themselves might become aware of later down the line, because they want to do something great and that they actually really do mean that. But when you do have to make sort of maybe very small but fundamental changes to some things, they need to be open to that, like adaptability, that changeability, and that's the most powerful thing, I think. If brands are doing that, if they're open to kind of say, guys, what do we need to do? What do we need to do differently? That's when we're in a really sweet spot to actually really help and change. Because unless they do that, and then, you know, we can't really steer that ship in the right direction. I hope that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And I think one of the things that always crosses my mind when I'm thinking about kind of the big brands, and for me, I don't know why, but the brands that usually come to mind are clothing brands. Maybe it's because it's the thing that I have the most issue with in terms of functionality. So like, yeah. Nike's a great one. So they do loads of kind of advertising these days with Paralympic athletes or kind of CrossFitters and all that sort of stuff. But when you actually go and buy their products, they don't fit me, like the shoes in particular. So the kind of wide shoes that they've got, I can only get one on my foot because they're actually not wide. And the kind of range that they've got, it's actually very small compared to the kind of range that you've got if you don't have issues with getting shoes and stuff in.
Yeah.
And I think one of the next changes that I'd like to see is that change from it just being, and just being sounds really, really kind of mean almost, but just being kind of marketing and the kind of the external visual that they're putting out, say, oh, we're amazing and we support you, which is lovely to hear, but actually I'd like to see action in your products. Do you see that
and, kind of stuff? And it is that. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes it comes the other way where a brand has an idea for adapting a product, and that's the start, but then they're not doing the fundamentals of marketing right. And we're there to help sort of turn it from just a PR thing to something that's actually genuinely engaging and representing everyone and supporting everyone. But you're totally right. More often than not, the representation piece can be easier than the product piece. So we tried, you know, we very much started with our bread and butter being like influencer, creator first, marketing, so social first campaigns. But over time, we realized that actually we should be offering a more 360 approach. So insights that underpin actually how the community think and feel and engage with the product, then consultancy to like enact that change, whether that's like their website experience, making sure it's more accessible, training their customer service staff, or talking about product and the accessibility of it, whatever it might be. And then maybe at that point, you know, if we had free rein, we don't only then at that point start, you know, maybe the representation piece, because we've got all of this wonderful inclusivity that's already happened before it. We know exactly what the community want and think. We then put that into place, and then we're shouting about it with great representation. Like, that's obviously perfection. That's what we would like. The reality is we can't ever get perfection, you know, for anyone. Ourselves as an agency, we're not perfect. No one's perfect. So it's about supporting brands to feel comfortable enough to take those first steps and iterate what they do over time. And more often than not, the biggest reason we, you know, we don't work with certain brands ends up being because they're too kind of scared almost to take that first step.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we're not going to be perfect. So we're worried to be vulnerable. And that's really what we try and cut through. And we try and say like, no, this is a safe space. Doing something is better than nothing. Being on the journey is better than not being on the journey. And we can support you to do this in an authentic way. So I think that if they start doing advertising well, then they then can kind of confidently look a bit more inwards and look at product. The only sort of, maybe the pessimist sort of in me would always say that ultimately, with whatever regard it is, business cases usually are the thing that ends up, you know, being the be all and end all of why certain things happen.
Yeah.
So if there's not a solid business case to making more adaptive and accessible products and services, that's quite a hard one to get pushed through. Yes, it might happen and it should happen. And yes, it might happen because it's the right thing to do with certain brands. But at the same time, it can feel like that will be an uphill battle, because if Nike are only going to sell 1,000 pairs of trainers that are perfectly fitted to you, but they're going to sell 50 million of another, are they going to go through the same innovative process to make the 1,000 pairs? Probably not. And that's rubbish. It's hard to think how like that's going to change a huge scale, you know what I mean? But over time, I think the understanding that everyone should have access to like equal opportunity, this will be another layer of that. So actually, it, you know, creating that parity of experience will be probably baked into the way brands have to conduct themselves more into the future, irrespective of like business case and margins and whatever it might be. I think the direction I'd like to see it go is that brands actually take that responsibility on to create things that are more accessible and more adaptable and more bespoke to different people, because that's the position they're in to be able to do that.
Yeah, and I think one of the observations that I have around it, shoes is my sticking point, because I currently can only wear one shoe, because I've got one foot that I have CRPS in, and the other one just has its normal arthritis and stuff, but generally is less changeable, I suppose. Whereas this CRPS one, so I don't know how much you know about it, but CRPS, your foot can go from looking relatively normal to being, you know, 2-3 times the size within a few minutes. And obviously that in itself is difficult. And I appreciate I'm probably not going to get shoes that are perfect for it. But one of the things that I remember when I was growing up, that there was much more that you could access that was different widths. So you had extra large widths, you had normal standard, and you had even skinny fits, whereas you don't see that as much in kind of adult shoes. And it almost makes me think it's a bit of a kind of chicken and egg scenario, in that we've got this situation now where, you know, brands have put all this product out there. It's selling because people need shoes. Yeah, let's take that example and run with it. So people need shoes, so they buy shoes. But is that actually the right product for them? Probably not in a lot of the cases, but they're still buying the shoes because they need to wear shoes.
Yeah.
And, yeah, until you can kind of really evaluate your point about really understanding the kind of the community and the needs and that type of thing and really evaluate that, I can understand why businesses then don't make that big shift. And Nike, to be fair, have got a relatively okay range of different shoes. So they've got the kind of CrossFit ones where you can slip into a bit easier, and they've got some kind of zip ones and stuff. So they are better than others. But it's still very, very limited, when actually, if you had that across the board, I'd be buying hundreds of Nike shoes because I love Nike shoes. I always have done.
Be a poor man.
It would be a very poor man, but I'd have lots of shoes, so it's fine. Whatever takes your fancy, after all. But I guess you've got to have that understanding of what that market really looks like, and it's difficult to understand that when people have to buy shoes to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, I don't wear shoes, so we've got one shoe between the two of us.
There you go.
I just had this epiphany when I was about 14 or 15. I was like, why am I wearing shoes? Because I don't walk.
Yeah.
And particularly for me, my feet are quite small, and a shoe, to your point, was always like way bigger than, even if it was technically fitting, it was just so clunky and cumbersome and actually stopped me moving my legs very easily. But, you know, it's just putting them on for the convention of people wear shoes. Mm. And I was like, why don't I wear shoes? And I genuinely, from that day onward, never wore shoes again, like at all. So I've just given my shoes that I had that are now obviously still pristine, because I literally just was in a wheelchair the whole time.
Yeah.
I've just given them to my nephew, who's like 3 and a half. And I don't think they quite fit him, but in a year or so, they're going to be this like shiny, brand new retro Reeboks from the 90s that he can wear. So he might think they're cool. I don't know. But it's fascinating, though.
I mean, it is a thing that I think you come to realize. I mean, I probably wear sliders more than anything else, mainly for kind of ease.
Yeah.
The time that I need to wear shoes is when I'm playing sport. So if I'm playing wheelchair rugby in particular, just kind of how your feet go into the wheelchair and stuff. Yeah. Whilst I do want my leg amputated, I don't really want it amputated whilst playing rugby. Excuse me. I mean, it's an evolving world, and I'm sure we will see some of that change kind of coming. If you look kind of forward from kind of Purple Goat and you know, looking at kind of what might come, are there any kind of brands that you look at and go, we could really do something really cool there, and those are the ones that we want to kind of get involved with?
I mean, I suppose the natural thing to say would be around like the blending of realities. And I know that sounds really like just pie in the sky mumbo jumbo a lot of the time, but the realization that at the very least, like augmented reality is very close around the corner, and therefore creating like extensions of accessible spaces that in the digital, like blending the digital and the physical world, is really like exciting in many ways. It's also kind of fraught with potential entrenched problems that we have right now. So I haven't yet like sort of done this, but we're thinking about getting a Apple Vision Pro, probably not keeping it, but we want to try it because my feel is that it's not going to suit a lot of different disabled people that are trying to use it. And I don't think that accessibility would have been built into the MVP product in a way that maybe, like, you know, the iPhone has iterated over time. So actually, it's got a load of really awesome accessible features in it now. But did it have all those features when it was launched? No. And we don't want this new world to, like, accelerate at 100 miles an hour and not be inclusive by design.
Yeah.
And I think that really is the area where I can see there being a lot of work and focus over the coming years. The opportunities will be massive, but then at the same time, there needs to be some level of, like, oversight to ensure that there really is, like, not us having to kind of retrospectively change things well into the future. You know, a really, really simple example is AI generated art. And yeah, you know, we type in disabled person into AI generated art, it will spit out a person in a wheelchair, it will probably be a man, it will probably be a white man, and more often than not, they'll be kind of grotesque in some way. And that just is, like, what happens. And so there's just such a, you know, you never see that image being created with a group of people having, like, a laugh or smiling, or a disabled person that isn't in a wheelchair talking to another person. Oh, so the nuance is not there. And I think that's, so AI, like, is one part of it, and then augmented reality, virtual reality, is another, where actually the opportunity is so vast and so big, but at the same time, we just really kind of want these brands to not just accelerate without actually stopping and making sure that they're just really and truly making things inclusive by design from the ground up as much as possible.
It kind of feels like that should be the standard for everything that's now being designed. And I know it's not, because even where I work, there's stuff that's been designed without thinking about the disabled population. It's going to happen until people are actively involved in the work ultimately, which I know is what Purple Goat are doing ultimately. One of the questions that I get asked a lot, and maybe you can shed a bit of light on this with the kind of work you do with Purple Goat, is how do people get more involved in this type of stuff? So how do you get to be part of an advertising campaign or part of, you know, trying to transform something? Like, what's a route into that these days?
I think there's so many layers of, like, of where you can sort of start to be engaged. I think so social media is one where it's giving people platforms to tell their stories. And that's lovely. It's giving people a sort of window into their world. And so we're seeing, you know, disabled content creators that are talking to the world, to hundreds of thousands, millions of people every day. And they are therefore able to, like, impart their wisdom, their knowledge, their thinking. And if we, as sort of consumers of content, are following 100,000, you know, 1,000 people with different experiences, we're going to get a really well-rounded view of that. And that's powerful. In terms of, like, being that, so, you know, not all of us want to be content creators. I don't personally, even though I work in and around hundreds of brilliant content creators every day. Like, I know that that's not something I would be able to do. But I do kind of work with different organizations, charities, bodies, to just be part of that kind of voice and steering of things. I'd be, very honestly, like, charities are a great place to start, where you can kind of support and help shape the direction of how they should, you know, direct themselves, but also lobby government around things, those kind of things. Engaging in conversations in and around social is a way to make connections and make friends. And that's another way. And then, you know, if you've got your favorite brands that you talk to and work with, then engage them as well. Like, I think the first that, like, if I think about the sort of first consultative work I ever did, it was because I just had poor experiences in restaurants, and I just sent them an email afterwards and gave them advice of how to change it. And that was me as a maybe 18-year-old or 19-year-old. I was like, I've had a really poor experience. I want to make it better for you, and I want to feel like I can come back. So here's a list of things you could do. Let me know when they're done, sort of thing. Mm. And yes, explain the problem. Yes, explain why it's important, and the opportunity that is there for them if they do it right. So I think that, you know, even something as simple as that, I've built relationships with brands through that kind of thing, 15, 20 years ago, and still kind of engaging with them in some shape or form now because of that kind of relationship. So it really is kind of multifaceted, and I would just encourage people to lean into the areas that they're really passionate about and just engage those conversations in those places.
Yeah, and the other thing I often say to people is think a bit outside of the box as well. I think there's sometimes this misconception that the only time that you're doing something great and important is when it's on social media. But actually, most of the things that are being done that are really changing the world for disabled people aren't being done on social media. They're being done in the background. They're being done in the boardrooms. They're being done by consultancy work, etc. So getting involved in all the different areas that you can. I mean, the NHS is a great example. I mean, they've got loads of programs that you can get involved with to be a kind of advisory. You get paid a little bit of money for it, which is nice as well. But ultimately, it helps steer some really important decisions that can influence people to have a better experience, which, yeah, that's what we should be striving for. I'm kind of conscious of time, as always, on these, because we also have such good conversations on The Safe Place. But I'm finishing off with one question for everybody on this season. And it's a very simple one. Not that easy to answer, but it's very simple. But how do you want to be remembered?
Bloody hell. As someone with a passion for life that enjoyed every day, that didn't take life too seriously, and had a lot of lovely people around them that made the world a better place.
Very good.
Maybe. That, something like that.
But you, so effectively, you want to be seen by the actions that you've taken and the influence that you've had. Is that kind of what
you're... Yeah. Yes, that... But then at the same time, like, life can be too serious sometimes. Mm. And actually, if your existence is one that created a positive impact on those around you, even if that's like the people in your home and your immediate vicinity, and you might create positive impact on that, and you feel good and you've enjoyed your innings, I think that's pretty sweet. And so, you know, I think the grandeur of having to change the world, actually, that's sort of, you know, it doesn't feel like it's something that anyone should aspire to be, because not only is that too much pressure, it's too much like ego involved in that. Yeah. I think it's actually like the way to like ground yourself much more is just like, is my impact I'm having enjoyable for me, but then also, and sustainable, but then at the same time, is it creating positive energy outside of me? And you take of that what you will, you know. And I think as long as you do that and you're kind of content, if you can be content then with that, then you found the sweet spot, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot, Dom. Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure.
If people want to kind of reach out, where can they find you?
I think most of my social handles are at Dom Hyams, so DOMHYAMS, and Dom at purplegoatagency.com if it's work related, and down the pub if it's drinking a beer related. So we'll have to do it sometime soon.
Indeed. Nice one. Thanks, Dom.
Pleasure, mate. Thanks for having me. Speak soon.